Okay, so we have the opportunity to discuss the second aliyah of Parshas Lech Lecha. And while that is not the same as the first aliyah, there are a number of overlapping themes which give us the opportunity to discuss some major Lech Lecha themes. First of all, this aliyah represents one of the nisyonos of Avraham Avinu, the struggle involving Sarah and Egypt is counted by Rashi and the Rambam as among the nisyonos. If you know Rashi's count and the Rambam's count is a little bit different. If you look in the Arch Scroll Chumash, I believe they have helpful charts showing you how the 10 nisyonos are counted according to the different Rishonim. But this makes both lists. This second aliyah is one of the nisyonos specifically of Avraham Avinu. And the topic of nisyonos is a major theme, which is this parsha and certainly next week's parsha is devoted to largely, and also what's not in the parsha, the famous question, which we have to make up a non-existent aliyah to discuss, why the incident of Ur Kasdan is not in the Torah at all, that whole episode with Nimrod's oven. It's much discussion about why such an important episode is conveyed to us not through the Chumash itself. So that's we'll have to find a year when there's no aliyah in order to discuss what's not in the parsha. But it's just this parsha itself, this aliyah itself, discusses one of the nisyonos. And there's much literature about nisyonos, about why is it that we have nisyonos, what is the purpose. You know, we certainly don't need the compliment, so to speak, if that's the idea, that Kadosh Baruch Hu is trying to say that we're great and he trusts us. So that's good, but it's got to be more than just an ego boost because of the pain that's involved. We would need it to be more than that. It's clearly, as the Rambam points out in Mor Nevuchim, it's not that it's not for God's sake that he has to test us. It's not that he doesn't know. It's not that when we talk about a test, so normally here you get a test in college, it's because the teacher doesn't know otherwise, perhaps, what the current state of your learning is. But to say that the Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't know, clearly that's not the case. So the purpose of a nisayon has to be something more than that. Perhaps it is to prove to ourselves what we are capable of. That's one possibility. Perhaps it is to give us schar. It's also something that's possible. To give us a kapara. Sometimes that's also involved. To make us stronger, no question. That in Hebrew, the expression is a little bit of a different usage, but it fits. And I say, Ein chacham kabal nisayon. There's nobody who's as wise, there's nobody who's as effective as somebody who has nisayon. So in the modern usage, they use nisayon to mean experience. But it fits very well here also, that the idea of somebody who's been through nisyonos, who has had to grow because of the confrontation of challenges, so that person ends up to be a stronger person. And therefore, nisyonos are a gift in that sense as well. But there's also a notion that many expressed that the idea of the nisayon is that we could have great attributes within us. We could have great potential within us. But if we don't actually actualize them, if it doesn't come to play in real life, so then it's not ours, really. So Kadosh Baruch Hu put these midos inside of us, that's terrific, but if we never utilize them, if we never rise to the occasion, so they're not really a part of us. They remain to be potential. And by actually standing up to a challenge and by utilizing these midos and these kochos that Kadosh Baruch Hu has given us, so then these attributes become ours. They become part of who we are actually. And we make a kinyan on them. The Rashiv of Kandyavner, Bovich, Sepsad Gavacha, would often talk about the idea that he thinks the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos everyone mistranslates. They say that Ezahu Ashir, who is rich? So what's the answer to that question according to the Mishnah in Avos? Sameach B'chalko. So how do you understand that? So it's almost always translated to mean somebody who is satisfied with what he has. He's not jealous of other people. He's not looking for more. He doesn't have dissatisfaction because he doesn't have enough. But the Rashiva pointed out that the Mishnah quotes a pasuk. It doesn't really fit with that. And that the idea is really something completely different the way he understood it. That Sameach b'chalko is able to be happy because the chelek that he has is his. He's actually earned it. He has actually made it a part of his own possessions. So that's what the Gemara says, that Rosh Adam Bekav Shalo Yosu Mites Chabin Shal Chaveru. A person would rather have something that's genuinely his rather than to possess even a much greater quantity of something that's not connected to him in a real sense. And so too, your midos, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us these qualities, these potentials, but they only really become ours when we make a kinyan on them, when there's a real challenge and we rise to the occasion and we make it a real chelik of who we are. So then it becomes actually a part of our existence. So that's one of the perspectives, a number of the perspectives that we have on the whole concept of nisyonos, and we benefit from the fact that our great ancestor, Avraham Avinu, Ma'isa Avos Simul Labanan, so he took on all the nisyonos himself. He took on, obviously there's many nisyonos left for his descendants as well, but he set the path in taking on 10 nisyonos that cover all kinds of different areas of life, all types of different challenges people could have. So when we daven all the time that we shouldn't be brought with day nisyonos, we don't want to have to confront these challenges. But if we have to, if we're forced to deal with challenges in our lives, we're able to look to Avraham Avinu, who dealt with all the different types of challenges, all the different kinds of issues that somebody could have. He provided a model. So all of these nisyonos are now in our national DNA, and we have the ability to look to the founder of the Jewish nation as a Ma'isa Avos Simul Labanan in addressing these challenges. So that's in terms of really all of Parshas Lech Lecha and Parshas Vayera. This Aliyah again talks about the specific challenge of coming to Egypt and dealing with the issue of how to keep Sarai safe throughout that experience. And in the previous Aliyah, so he had told her that he's going to pretend that she is his sister. And here we find the beginning of Sheni. So the pasuk says, "Vayhi kivo Avraham Mitzrayma v'yiru haMitzrim es haisha ki afahim ma'od." So it was as Avram came to Mitzrayim. So kivo Avram. So that's singular, and he went together with Sarai. So why is it singular? So Rashi quotes the interpretation that he put her in a box, that he tried to hide her from the Mitzrim. They shouldn't see what she was like. They shouldn't be attracted to her. But then they wanted to collect the taxes, so they found her. You know, Rashi tells us the whole, Rashi tells us about this. The Medrash goes into greater detail that he tried to keep things quiet. And they asked him what he was carrying, and he said, just a chita. And they said, we don't believe you. We think it's more valuable. We think it's a sarum. So he says, okay, I'll pay taxes at the higher level. And they say, well, in that case, we don't believe you as that. We think you have cupcakes in there. So he says, okay, I'll pay for the cupcakes. Well, in that case, we don't believe that. We think it's gold. Kept going up and up and up, and they realized he was willing to pay anything in order to not have them open the box. So they opened the box, and they discovered that Sarai was in there. So the Nitziv discusses this in his commentary, and the Nitziv asks, what did Avram really think? Did he think that this was going to work the whole trip? That he was going to go his entire time in Mitzrayim having her in a box, and it's never going to come out, and that's going to be a joyous vacation? How's that going to work exactly, that he's going to hide her in the box the whole time? So the Nitziv said that's itself a question, that he probably thought he had to get to the next stage and then he'll figure it out. First challenge was to get through this inspection and as he entered, and that was the biggest time of danger, but he thought he would get past that and then he'll come up with a different plan. But he didn't even get that far. So he was exposed at that point. So the Nitziv has a comment which is also possibly a statement about this whole Parsha as a whole. And he says it's the Yesod in general, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's way, when he's dealing with the faithful, when he's dealing with people who have bitachon in him, that often what HaKadosh Baruch Hu will do is he will shter their plans, he'll mess up their plans, and he'll end up saving them a different way that they never even thought of. He'll end up bringing them to Yeshua in a way that comes out completely out of left field. So here Avram thinks that I have to hide Sarai in the box in order to protect her, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu messes up that plan, it ends up that the box gets open, and nonetheless, she still gets saved. The goal was still accomplished. God is still protecting his faithful, but adding to the Emunah challenge, in a sense, by doing it in a way that they couldn't imagine. And that's an opportunity, I'll use Sheni as a Pesach to other things, to talk a little bit about Rishon of Lech Lecha and also Vayera, you know, that we read next week about the ultimate Nisayon, about the Nisayon of the Akedah. And this week we read about the first of the Nisayonos of the Lech Lecha. And the question often comes up, the Lech Lecha is a Nisayon which is hard to understand. It says, Lech Lecha, you should go. As Rashi tells us, L'hanaschel tovaschel, it's going to be good for you. So what kind of a Nisayon is that? Right, so listen, I want you to go on a trip to a 5-star hotel and we'll pay for you there and you'll have everything tended to. And it's a tremendous Nisayon to see if you'll say yes or not. What kind of a Nisayon is that? That's not much of a challenge. And in fact, the Medrash then makes it even harder to understand, because the Medrash quotes an opinion that says, I don't know which Nisayon was greater. Lech Lecha Me'artzecha or Lech Lecha Har Maria. In other words, the Akedah. What was harder? Go to Eretz Yisrael or go sacrifice your sons? How could it be that there's any kind of comparison between the two? It doesn't seem like they're anything alike. So the central question of what the Nisayon was in terms of Lech Lecha is one that's important to address. And perhaps if you look at the Akedah for a second also, what exactly was the nature of the Nisayon of the Akedah? It's a little bit mysterious, because since the plan, what seemed to be the plan, changes at the last second, so we have to try to pinpoint what was it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was trying to convey here. What was the Nisayon? Is the Nisayon to see, so to speak, again, not that God has to see anything, but to see if Avraham was going to listen, and then turns out that was the wrong instruction to begin with. What exactly the nature of the Akedah is hard to understand in terms of what the Nisayon was meant to accomplish. And I think one possible theory that is hinted at in some Svarim and might be relevant here as well, we're talking about the Akedah for a moment, is that the purpose of Nisayon is really about Emunah, it's really strictly about faith, and it places new contexts in which faith can be expanded. And if you think about what the Akedah represents, so we focus on the fact that have to Chalila to sacrifice one's child, sounds like an unbelievable Nisayon, and of course it was, but there's a whole other Nisayon going on here which we don't always pay attention to when we talk about the Akedah. That here, keep in mind, God has told Avram, you are going to be the father of a great nation, you are going to have many descendants. Now here Avram has to wait a long time before having children, he has to wait a long time before having Yitzchak, and God has also said, Ki bi Yitzchak, Yikara l'chazara, that the descendants are going to come through Yitzchak. It's not that you could think that Yishmael or some other child is going to be the source of these great descendants, but that they're going to come from Yitzchak. So here Yitzchak takes a very long time to come around in the first place, and now here Yitzchak's not married yet, and look how close Avram comes to Shechting. So you can imagine every moment as he comes closer to the mountain and he thinks that his mission is that he has to kill this one son who's supposed to be the source of his great nation of descendants. So how hard must it be to have any emunah in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan? Not just the challenge of having to sacrifice your son, but God's plan was something that now seems absolutely impossible. What's the scenario that's really going to come true? And then, at the last second, he's told that wasn't actually the instruction. So you see, there is a certain challenge there in terms of emunah, that here it looks like God has a promise that cannot come true, that if things are going to progress, it's impossible for it to be what he said. And yet, that's not the case. Yet, it is meant to happen. So we can see how there is a tremendous challenge to emunah in that sense. If you have a question, we'll take it a second. Just want to apply it here, and I'll take a question in a second. That, so if you go back to Lech Lecha, so there is a very prevalent mentality among human beings that even if God's going to say, listen, go there, Lech Lecha, and it's going to work out for you well, it's going to be to your benefit. So it's still human nature to say, listen, I had a plan, and I expect my plan to work out. So if I'm going to succeed, why can't I succeed the way I plan to succeed? So let me benefit here. And for Avram to be able to have the emunah when God says, listen, you're going to succeed, but you have to trust me that it's not going to be the way you think, that it's going to involve your getting up and moving and uprooting yourself, and that's where the haslacha is going to come. That's a test of emunah, which resonates very strongly with us today, because you know, we are obligated as responsible people to have plans and to have an agenda for how we're going to make our life successful. But so often that's not the way it works out. So often we have successful, happy lives, but we never could have imagined it was going to be the way it turned out. We never could have guessed the various steps. So that's also a part of Emunah, that however Kadosh Baruch Hu's plan is going to manifest itself, it's ultimately for the best. But it being for the best doesn't mean that it's going to be along the lines that we thought. It doesn't mean it's going to involve the place or the context or the steps or the predictable path. And that itself takes a tremendous amount of Emunah. And that's what he's saying, Lech Lecha, that you should go. And that's a Nisonian. Even if I'm telling you it's going to be great and fantastic, to follow that and to believe that is itself a Nisonian Emunah. So perhaps that's the idea that Itziv is saying here also on this pasuk, that even when dealing with the faithful like Avraham Avinu, so Kadosh Baruch Hu has this way of increasing the Emunah, that even when you think you have a plan, how you're going to save yourself, so God will still save you, but He'll davka save you in a way that you never thought of. He'll davka, as if he's a lahavdil, a screenwriter who tries to keep the guesses coming until the very end, and he tries to keep the last few minutes, everything's going to have to keep getting undone until the very last scene when everything works out. So life is like that sometimes also. So you think, okay, you're going to have the plan will get fresh there, the box is going to get opened, the tax inspectors are going to find Sarai, and still in the end it's going to work out, but the salvation is going to come from somewhere where you never guessed. And that's also perhaps a lesson in Emunah that's very much of a piece with all of the nisyonos that we read about before and after this one. So, Michelle, I'm sorry I pushed you off before.
No, I was just curious what the Rebbe's opinion is a little bit on the. Some people criticize Avraham with the Akedah that maybe he was supposed to speak up and not just have by the Emunah, but say, Hashem, like, what's going on? Because after the Akedah, there's no written. We don't know that Avraham ever speaks to Hashem again. He never says they have a conversation. It seems like possibly he made a mistake there. So I'm just curious what the...
Yeah, I think to say that he was supposed to object is very difficult. It doesn't really match the sources that we have. It doesn't really match the Lashana liturgy. It doesn't really match anything that we are told about how he functioned within the Nisayon, the whole Masorah that he passed the Nisayon. So I find that a very difficult interpretation and challenging in a very central way. I think there are other ways to say what I said just now was one of the aspects that I think is relevant in terms of the Nisayon. I think clearly, we're not a religion based on child sacrifice, so this isn't about that that was the goal. I think that what we just said now is one of the perspectives, that the Nisayon was about having a situation where it seemed almost impossible that God's promise could ever come true. I think there are other possibilities as well. Maybe we could justify speaking about it next week within our rules in terms of Vayer. We'll see maybe if we have an opportunity to say a little bit more about it. Okay, so, hi.
Can you just look at the analogy that you guys, like the reverse, everything really questions with that? You're saying that part of the reason that the Nisayon was intensified or magnified is because Avraham was already told that, this is how it's going to work out, and that, it took a long time for him to have Yitzchak, and that was being told he has to kill Yitzchak, and so that must make it even worse. But can you just look at it as, no, if he was never told that, then that would make this very hard, because then you'd be thinking, well, how am I going to perpetuate my legacy? Avraham could have been thinking, I was already told that somehow this is going to work out, so maybe it's not as difficult as he said.
Except that he clearly believed that he was going to kill him. That's clearly what he thought the challenge was. So within the technology available to humanity at that time, there really is no resolution to that. And so to come up with a way in which that would all work out involves, even if you do have full belief in the Havtacha, but still, so for it to materialize in your mind, you can't envision it. So it happens so often in life, where you just can't imagine how something could work out. It's one of the fascinating things we have expression, Yeshua Hashem Keharafayim. Right, but he was told that the Masorah was not going to go through Yishmael. Ki b'Yitzchak yikar l'chazar. You know that it wasn't going to come from Yishmael. Theoretically, he could even believe he'd have more kids, but it was told that the Masorah was going to come through Yitzchak. So they had this idea, Yeshua Hashem Keharafayim, that God's redemption can come in the blink of an eye. And that's a very powerful idea, because it's easy to imagine how chas v'shalom, chalila b'chas, somebody's life can change for the worse in an instant. We can all think of scenarios, we don't want to think of scenarios, where something can happen in a second that can change your life for the worse right away. But it's very hard to imagine scenarios where sometimes, depending on people's circumstances, very often hard to imagine scenarios where your problems can be solved in an instant. You can have problems, maybe you don't have such problems, but many of us have problems where it's very hard to imagine that you can think of anything that could happen right now that will reverse the situation. And yet, often enough it happens, often enough, in a blink of an eye, very quickly, something happens that flips everything around in a positive direction. And not only would you have said it's unlikely to happen, you couldn't even imagine what it would be that you would want to happen. That's the level of difficulty it is to be masing. And yet it happens. So that happens in life a lot, and that's where Avraham was confronting, that based on what the parts he had to deal with, there was no resolution, there was nothing. What could he imagine happening that would make this work? And yet it did, and yet here we are, in the descendants. So there is a level of emunah that's being brought out and that's being challenged, and that perhaps is reflected here. There is an interesting discussion. There's a sefer called the Knesset HaGedola. Knesset HaGedola is a sefer of halacha, very often quoted by the Nosekeim of Shulchan Aruch. It's organized in the state of Shulchan Aruch as Reb Chaim Ben Avisti, very important, often referenced sefer of halacha. But in the back, he has all kinds of different things. And he has some comments on the Chumash. And some of the comments on the Mefarshim and Chumash, he talks about Rashi, he talks about the others. So he has a lot to say about this Aliyah. It's interesting. You can look, it's published in the back of the Knesset HaGedola. You can find it on Hebrew books, but the print is impossible to read. You should get the physical edition. But he has a lot to say specifically about this Aliyah, just what the words mean. And he talks about a number of psukim to try to interpret, but he also explains a lot of these ideas, this idea of the teva and the like, and of Ram hiding Sarai. So he goes through the whole idea that all of this was to perpetuate this plan that Sarai was his sister as opposed to his wife. So the idea of hiding her in the teva, so he thought that even if it's going to be discovered, but presumably a person wouldn't treat his wife that way, wouldn't hide his wife in the teva. And the flip side, he said that had she not been in the teva, so it would have been impossible to claim that she was anything other than his wife, because the relationship between them would have made it so obvious. So just like with Yitzchak and Avimelech, he figured out that it was his wife, so too it would have been impossible for Avram to conceal that she was his wife. But once he puts her in the teva, so then that, even if she ends up being discovered, it at least makes it feasible that he could present her as his sister. And that's also why he accepts all these gifts. And it's very hard to understand. The Rashi at the end of the previous Aliyah has always, I'm sure, been a challenge to many of us. When you read that Rashi, it seems so un-Avrahamic, right? So he says, the last pasuk in the Rishon says, Aman yitav li b'avoreich. So Rashi says, she give me gifts. That was the whole thing, that Avram had this plan so he should get rich. This is the same Avram who later in this parsha refuses to accept anything from the kings. So this is the one who has the plan to hide his wife so that he should get gifts. So that's very hard to understand. So he discusses this to Knesset HaGedola, and he says that the whole point of the gifts was just to perpetuate this message, because a person, presumably a guy, somebody is interested in somebody's wife, so maybe they'll kill that person, but they're not going to give that person gifts. That's not going to do anything to get the person's wife away from him. But if it's a sister, so then okay, you may want to be machnif the brother, you may want to flatter the brother and give him presents and do whatever you can in an effort to win over his sister. So this isn't because he wanted the gifts, this is because it was all a part of this plan, which indeed we see happens, that he ends up getting a lot of gifts for that purpose. But this was all part of what he was trying to do. And that's part of what Paro was so upset. But later Paro says to him, really, it's two questions. And Pasuk Yitches, Paro says, Vayikra Paro la Avram, Vayomer ma'azos asisa li, lama lo higadata li ki ishtacha li. So it's two questions. Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? And also, ma'azos asisa li, what'd you do to me? So he says there's really two things going on. That on the one hand, he was silent about the fact that she was his wife. He didn't say anything about that. That was a sin of omission, so to speak, in Paro's eyes. But it was also a sin of commission that he also maybe didn't say she was his sister, but he did all kinds of actions and maneuvers to make it look like she was his sister and created that impression. So it's two separate offenses, so to speak, for Paro, and that's what is referred to here. So then he goes on to say, so why did he just not duke it out? This is, again, the same Avram who fights all the kings later. He clearly is a powerful guy. So why did he not just fight Paro for him? So he suggests that it was a little bit less of a just war, so to speak, that in the case of Lot, they came into his territory and they chapped him. So it's justified that they'll make war in order to save him, in order to rescue the hostage. In the case of Sarai, so they're coming onto Egyptian territory and they're, so to speak, bringing the situation to them, so they'll do what they have to in order to protect her, but the war is not as justifiable a method as would otherwise be. Okay, so the pasuk then continues. Next pasuk, v'yiru osa sarei faro, v'yahalu osa el paro, v'atuka chayisha beis paro. So they saw her, and they praised her. It's interesting how to translate this pasuk a little bit. Le'halu osa el paro. So if you look in that Knesset HaGedolah, it's a long piece in the Knesset HaGedolah. So he talks about how to translate that pasuk. It's a little bit difficult. What does that mean? That they praised her to Paro, so Paro's not here right now. So they went to Paro and praised her. Or it means they praised her regarding Paro, that she was somebody who was worthy of Paro. So if you want to figure out exactly the proper translation of how that phrase should be read, that's one of the themes that he takes up over there in the Knesset HaGedolah. But in any event, they found her to be worthy, and they took her to Paro. And Chazal tell us that Paro was so interested in her, so he gave her as a ksuba, as a potential dowry in order to marry her, he gave her the land of Goshen, which, as we know, ends up being the Jewish property in Egypt later. And there's an essay about this, the Lev Elio, Relio Lopian, talks about how you see the effect that ownership can have even on inanimate objects, even on property, that the tzaddikus like Sarai, she essentially sanctified Goshen through her ownership. Paro never took it back. This was a property that was given to Sarai in this circumstance and was always really theirs. So ultimately the Jews in Egypt end up settling there, and the Levium end up staying there, which is really, as he discusses, why they were not a part of the Shiblit, because it was a safe zone. All of this legacy from the fact that Sarai had once owned it. So the Kedusha of a Tzaddik having a connection to something, and the effect that the righteous person has on everything in their orbit is reflected in this idea that Goshen essentially is a Neskadish, like Eretz Yisrael, just like the whole land of Eretz Yisrael, which is itself a major theme of this parsha, becomes sanctified through the presence of the Jewish people. So Goshen also, it goes back to, it's like Eretz Yisrael in miniature, so to speak. Well, Havdil, I guess, but it's a somewhat of a comparison that Sarai is the initial owner here, and that creates its Jewish character even so many generations later. So then the next pasuk continues, that again this reflects the pasuk we mentioned before, the end of Rishon, Laman Yitav Li Bavareich. So here the pasuk says, Uli Avram Heitiv Bavura Vahilo Tzon of Akar V'chamorim V'avadim V'shvachos V'ason V'sugmalim. But indeed he did well because of her, and he was given these gifts as the plan seemed to suggest. So the Gemara, here's a little Bav Metzia synergy. The Gemara in the end of Azav, in Bav Metzia and Daf Nentes, the Gemara says, what do you see from here? It's an interesting lesson if you think about how it's being derived, that a person should always be careful with his wife, with the honor of his wife, because all bracha, all good things comes to a person because of his wife. And that's what's being conveyed here, that Heitiv Bavura, that Avram did well because of Sarai. So this is really it's a powerful statement, and that's true. You know, we believe that marriage to the right person brings about completion in all senses of the word, and brings about bracha in the absolute sense, and that's why a person should be careful to choose properly, and then to properly honor the relationship. But also, if you pay attention here, so this good was coming to him because they didn't know she was his wife. That was the whole point. They thought that she was his sister. She was not his wife. So what the Gemara is apparently saying is it doesn't just mean directly, that people will want to hang out with you as a couple because your wife is nice, and therefore they'll give you respect because they like your wife, which happens also. It's also a mila. But here, just on a spiritual level, even the people who don't know that she's your wife, but bracha ultimately comes to you. If you have the right wife, you have the right partner in life, and therefore one should always be especially careful about that. So that's brought la halacha. The Rambam in Hilchos Ishus, in Perek Tesvav, Halacha Yites, he records the obligation to be especially careful in the treatment of one's wife, and there's a Tshuva of the Maharam in Gutenberg, and the Beis Yosef quotes it, in Kufnun Dalit. And the Chi of Kavod, the Magid Mishnah, on the side of the Rambam, so he says that it's from a different Gemara. And the Gemara Masechet Yevamos and Daf Samach Bei, so that's synergy with last year, so it's a unity between last year and this year. So there the Gemara says, or quotes a pasuk, and it refers to the idea that a person towards his wife, Machabda Yoser Megufo, that he should respect her even more than he respects himself. So the Magid Mishnah quotes that as the makar, as a whole discussion. So what's the primary makar? Is it this Gemara of Messiah that comments on this pasuk? Or play the symphony out there. Or is it that Gemara and Yevamos that's the real makar? So presumably, as some of the Svarim point out, it's two separate things. The Gemara and Yevamos is telling us a chiyuv, is telling us an obligation. So that's what the Rambam quotes as a din. While this Gemara is telling us good advice. It's saying that you see that people who are careful in terms of their marital relationships, so things work out for them. So it's good advice to be very careful how you treat your wife, and it's also a din, it's also a mitzvah, that one has to be careful to show proper respect to his wife. It's interesting language, the yoser megufo, that a person should respect his wife more than himself. So some of the mefarshim say it means that we're talking about providing clothing and the like, so you should make sure she's better dressed than you are, that you should worry about that for her more than you worry about yourself. But one could perhaps suggest that there's another idea here as well, that the general principle of human interaction is v'ahavt lo'recha kamocha, which the Gemara in Kedushin also quotes in the context of a wife as well. But that's general reciprocity, and the idea that you should treat someone the way you would want to be treated to. The way you would want to be treated, as Hillel famously phrased it in the negative in Aramaic, Ma'ad Allah sani l'chevrach alo savin, you shouldn't do badly, you shouldn't do bad things to someone else that you wouldn't want done to yourself. So as a general rule of thumb, that's a good idea. Treat other people the way you would want to be treated. Don't do things to other people that you wouldn't want done. But the nature of a marital relationship and the differences between men and women, it's hard to use that. And we know there are many frictions in marriages because of that, because people assume, the husband assumes the wife wants whatever the husband would want if he was her. So he doesn't go out of his way to treat her differently. And he doesn't recognize that women have different needs and that there's all types of a different mentality. And it's not going to work. You're not going to have a successful marriage if the husband is only treating his wife in terms of what he says to her, in terms of what he gives her, in terms of what he provides for her. If he'll only provide for her what he wants for himself, if he'll only, as we said before, dress her the way he would dress himself, if he would only talk to her the way he cares about being talked to, so he's not going to have a successful relationship. It's not going to work. Women need a whole different level of attention and sympathy and understanding. And perhaps that's what's being suggested here of Yosa Migufa, that you have to recognize that it's not the same. You know, it's not the same yardstick of saying whatever you would want for yourself, this is what you want for this individual who you're with. You have to recognize that it takes a whole different type of perspective. And therefore we say, Yosu Megufo, even more than yourself, that's the attitude that has to be brought to the relationship. Okay, so move on a little bit. So the next pasuk says, Vayinaga Hashem es paro negayim gedolim. So paro gets tremendous negayim, gets tremendous affliction. V.S. Beiso, his household as well, Aldavar Sarai, Esha Savram, because of this matter of Sarai. So it's interesting that this is different than Avimelech. Avimelech gets a much better deal. He gets warned off. God comes to him in a dream and helps him to avoid these kinds of problems. So it's not equitable treatment. And Reb Simcha Zissel Broyden, the Sefer Son Derech, commenting over there by Avimelech, so he notes that there are two different types of people who might end up sinning. Somebody who doesn't want to sin but might end up sinning, and somebody who does want to sin and may end up sinning. So Avimelech was the first type. He really didn't want to sin, but he could have ended up sinning because of his misreading of the situation. And Paro, who really did want to sin. So therefore, Paro gets slapped in the face. Paro gets scared off. Paro gets hurt, rather, in order to prevent him from doing what he would have wanted to do. While Avimelech gets the gentler treatment, that he gets saved from his potential mistake. And that's a lesson about the different types that exist in the world. Move on a little bit, so this next question we spoke about already, the test what Yikra Paro La'avram did already. And Lama Amarta Achosihi, V'yakacho Sol Yisha, V'yatohine Ishtacha Akach V'leich. So he sends him out. And then the next pasuk says, V'yitzavol of Paro Anosha, V'yishlechu Osol, V'yas Ishto, V'yas Kol Asher Lo. So Paro commanded people to escort him out, and he sent them out, him and his wife, and everything that they had with them. So really the image this conjures, and we'll talk about this in a second, is, you know, when somebody gets fired from a company and they don't give him any notice because they're afraid that he's going to steal secrets, so he gets fired and they escort him out right away. Security walks with him and makes sure he doesn't take anything. So that kind of sounds like what's going on here, that Paro realizes that this is a difficult relationship here, so he sends him out of the country right away, and he has him escorted. The Gemara has a more positive spin on it. It's interesting. The Gemara says in Sota that this was an act of levaya, this was an act of escorting, it's a mitzvah, and because of this escorting, the four psios, the four steps, which doesn't say in the pasuk, but that's apparently a reference to the idea that the mitzvah of escorting, we assume, is four amos, or four steps. So because of that, so Paro was zochet to 400 years of slavery from the Jews. So it's hard to understand what that means. The Gemara in Sota, and Daphne Vav Midbeis, doesn't seem to be, as the Torah Tamima notes, it's hard to imagine this is an onus for Avram. Avram didn't do anything wrong here, but this is a statement that this act of kavod that Paro is doing here is a schus for him, so that instead of them being slave to a different royalty, whatever had to happen to the Jews happens in the context of Paro. Paro gets the benefit of it as a payment for this act of dignity that's provided through Levaya. Again, you could have read the pasuk as an undignified way, and we'll talk about that more in a second, but that's how the Gemara seems to understand it, and therefore even that represents itself as it's close down the line. Hi.
Does that mean that Paro is also so glad to be the
fuzzy end of the lollipop
in terms of
the tabacos? Fuzzy end of the lollipop? I mean, how do you want to apply that?
Like, if Paro was so glad to sleep, he was also so glad to get the bad end of the
deal. I mean, in the end, it was a bad deal.
Yeah.
Right, ultimately you're saying so that you'd be better off never having slavery in the first place. So that's an interesting question how you view it. He had many years of good labor and many years of good service. So in fact, maybe he would be better off. Or the point is that ultimately there's a cheshbon for everything, so how that ended up is a punishment for other things. But whatever benefit came to him along the way could have just been all straight suffering from it. Whatever benefit came to him along the way came as a schus of this. But again, it's a little bit difficult because besides that, the pasuk sounds a little bit different. Now, it's interesting, so many people, Parshas Lech Lecha, so they talk about, they look for themes in the Parsha to talk about. So they'll talk about Yishuv Eretz Yisrael and the like because it seems to be a mitzvah that's very relevant to this week's Parsha. Lech Lecha Mi'artzecha, the beginning of Ram was told to go to Eretz Yisrael. So that's a mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz, is often one of the, if you're looking for a Parsha topic, Lech Lecha will often get a topic for that reason. But you could just as much give it for this next pasuk, because the next pasuk tells us that Avram left Mitzrayim and went back to the Negev. So how does it say it? Vayal Avram in Mitzrayim. So he went up. So we know that in contemporary language, we call going to Eretz Yisrael, we call it Aliyah. So even though this was a physical ascension, that it's both north of Egypt and it's also going up a mountain, but there is a reference here to a spiritual ascendancy. And Rav Soloveitchik talks about this at some length. You know, they came out with, Soloveitchik's been especially prolific since he passed away, a lot of books that were published in these past few years by the beautiful Amir Tzohar Rav Foundation. They really do wonderful work. It's really amazing. So not so long ago, a book came out called Abraham's Journey, about the life of Avraham Avinu and the thought of Rav Soloveitchik. So he talks about this, And he notes that this was a real turning point in Avram's life, that Avram went to Egypt and he saw a real spiritual degradation, and he left re-energized to really try to change the world and to try to bring spirituality to humanity. So the ascension out of Egypt towards Eretz Yisrael was not only the physical going up the mountain, going north, but it was Avram really now rising a new level. This Nisayon has brought him, this encounter with the degradation of Egyptian society has taken him to a new level in his avodah, and therefore the Vayal represents that. In the context of discussing this, the Rav also notes that if you look, that Sarai is always referenced when HaKadosh Baruch Hu talks about Sarai, when he's the one speaking, so to speak. So it's always the reference to her together with Avram. But the psukim that talk about the relationship of the Egyptians to her, so her name is never mentioned. It's always, as you look in Pasuk Tesvav, you see Sarai, not Sarai. Sarai faro vehalu osa, viru osa, vatikach haisha. So she's always referred to without a name. She's anonymous. And that, he says, is part of the whole issue. That here Sarai is an unbelievable tzaddikus, an unbelievable koach in every way. And Chazal tell us that she was actually the stronger of the two, spiritually and personality-wise. She was the one who was really the driving force of this power couple. And when she comes to Egypt, she's nothing. She's just a woman. She's just completely anonymous. There's no relating to her as a human being. And that is part of the degradation of Egyptian society and how they were focused on her as a complete non-entity other than being a woman. And he then suggests that that's also how you read the Pasuk that we saw a few psukim ago, Pasuk Yizayin, that Paro was afflicted al devar Sarai. He was afflicted on the matter of Sarai Ishasavu. That the offense was the offense of devaluing Sarai, that to him he was just a woman. She was just a woman, and to all the Egyptian people she was an anonymous female, and that was an offense against Sarai. Sarai is a person with a name whose name is going to be changed into an even greater name, but a person of tremendous, tremendous stature in every sense of the word, and the Egyptians degraded that and didn't appreciate that, and that's what's reflected by that usage, and that's also what Avram is ascending from. Avram is leaving, he's going up, he's coming out of that degradation. And in that context, he also says, we were saying a second ago, that the idea that the escort here was a dignified escort, it's a little bit at odds with the way the psukim sound. So the Rav builds on the way the psukim seem to relate, that Avram also recognized that as a person who was going to be dealing with society the way he was, he's going to have to put up with a lot of garbage from people. He's going to be degraded all the time, and he's going to have to deal with it, v'nafshi ke'afar l'chol siyad, to be able to just take it and move on. So look what a tremendous embarrassment this is, that here he is treated like he's a security risk and he's escorted out of the country. He's essentially deported. All right, so he takes it and he moves on and he ascends. And that's what we find represented here. Okay, so then the next pasuk tells us that he was wealthy and that he had the Avram Kaved Ma'od, the Mikne B'Kesef V'Zav. He had a lot of gold and silver too. So it's not clear where the gold and silver came from. Hi?
So we're coming to an interesting addition there.
It's weighed down? You mean that he's...
Yeah, like it seems like that would, when he's leaving, make rachush. It's like, I feel like there's a lot of different words that...
As if it's trying to show that...
There might be something.
Maybe. Yeah, but it's also interesting because where the money come from, and maybe it sounds like he sold some of these items he was given, in which case he would probably be less heavy, I guess, than the money. Usually that's what we'd see with the Meister Shani, we sell the items so that we can carry them. So it's a little bit the opposite. And maybe it means that he was weighed down somehow as also part of the Nisayon by everything that he was given. But there's an interesting comment. I'm not sure what to make of it, but if you look at Neos Nayim LaTorah in Lutzke Rav, so he just notes that we say, Maisav or Simon Labanim, that the ancestors, they set the path for the descendants. So it seems to be, we talked about it a few minutes ago in terms of rising to Nisyonos and rising to the challenges. But he says in a very literal sense also, Avram was kind of carrying, was kind of covering all the same territory. So he notes all the different parallels. that we see what's going to happen in terms of what happens to Avram here and what's going to happen to the Jews later. So he leaves Canaan, right? So that happens. He goes into Egypt, just like the Jews ultimately will. He gets thrown out of Egypt, you know, the language that Paro will ultimately use towards the Jewish people, at least at one stage. He is he makes a mizbeach next to his ohel, which is very similar to the Mishkan. He ties up his son by the Mokum HaMikdash. He ends up bringing Makos onto Paro, and he ends up leaving with a lot of gold, which is also perhaps a precedent for the Jews in Egypt. So it's just interesting that in a macro sense, that everything that's going to happen to the Jews later is in essence sort of played out by Avram in the episodes that we read in this parsha, which is, again, I'm not sure what to make of it, but it's an interesting observation. So then the pasuk continues, or almost here at the end of the pasuk continues, Vayelech l'masav minegev yad beisel ad hamakom asher hayasham ohalo beschila bein beisel ubein ha'ay. So he went on his way. The Netziv emphasizes that until he got to the Negev, until he got to Eretz Yisrael, he rushed. He let the animals lag behind, and he let the people who were with him take care of the animals, because it was a mitzvah of Aliyah Eretz Yisrael, so that he did quickly. Once he was in Eretz Yisrael, he still wanted to go from there to Beit El, so that wasn't so much of a rush. He was already now in Eretz Yisrael, so then he slowed down and took care of the animals himself, because that was also a important topic. So Rashi says that this path that he took, so he took the same path and he paid back all of his creditors. That he went to all the inns, all of the motels that he stayed in along the way. He went to the same motels on the way back and he paid back his debts. Apparently he didn't have what to pay them with on the way there. It was an famine situation. And now he's rich. He came back and he paid off all his debts. So the Oznayim Torah comments, it's interesting, first of all, that he had debts, because even if he didn't have any money going down, but the idea that they trusted him to come back, he's this wandering guy, how did they know he was going to come back? So it's interesting if that's really what it means. So he quotes from the Zakan Aaron, the Chuvus, Rav Aaron Walkin was a great posek with the Chuvus Zakan Aaron, apparently his brother-in-law. So he said that he thinks the pshat in this pasuk is that Avram, it wasn't his fault, he had no choice, but Avram made kind of a chil Hashem coming down. Because here Avram is God's big advocate in this world. God tells him to go to Eretz Yisrael, he gets up, he moves to Eretz Yisrael. And what happens? He can't even be supported there. He's not even being given food. So here God's best servant is not even being supported by God. So the fact that he wanders down, he comes down through all these motels and he's starving and he's a poor person, it looks bad. It's a shtikal achil Hashem. It makes the people who saw him and encountered him think, oh, so where is your God now? And his power says, where is your God to take care of you? If you did everything he asked, how come you're so poor? So now on the way back, Avram's much better off. He not only got food, but now he's a wealthy man. So now he goes back to all of these places, and now when he pays them off, so now they can see that Taka was all for the best, the same points we were making at the beginning, that it's all ultimately a plan that works out best for him. So it was important that the same people who saw him on the way down should see him on the way up. The same people who thought that God wasn't taking care of him, they should see that God was taking care of him. And therefore, he says, that's the idea, he paid off his debts. It doesn't just mean, or even mean, that there were actual ledgers open that he had debts to in these motels. Maybe he meant that also, but the emphasis is that he was taking care of the problem he created. That he created, again, it wasn't his fault, he had no choice, but that there was a Chil Hashem that was created by going down through these paths, so he had to fix the Chil Hashem by coming back up through the same places in order to address that. The Tzlach, without going into all this detail, the Tzlach has a similar comment in his drashas, in his first drasha, where he says that there's a remez here that when a person does tshuva, so there's a spiritual implication here. A person has to also try to fix everything that he did along the way. So tshuva is davka about not just changing path or changing direction, but when you change direction, you go on the same path you came in the opposite direction. You have to do what you can to fix everything. And that's a part of it. It's particularly interesting you know, that just to think about the parallels, that the Torah seems to say there's an Isser to go back to Mitzrayim after Yetzias Mitzrayim, and there's a whole discussion of how do we understand that, and is that true Maisa, an Isser to go, or a problem, a whole story. So among the theories about this issue is that there's Davka and Isser to go back the same path you went. So that's it's an interesting idea, just a parallel to here. That here we're emphasizing that he came back to Eretz Yisrael on the same path that he went away from Eretz Yisrael, and that's a good thing. So it's perhaps it's an especially bad thing, not stam to go back to Mitzrayim, but to go back to Mitzrayim along the same path. So that's an interesting idea. The Gemara says about this point that there's a midas derech eretz, that a person shouldn't change achsaniya shalom, a person should keep with the same hosts. So therefore, the same people who hosted him on the way down, he went back and stayed by them on the way up. Sometimes your host will say, you know, we wouldn't mind if once in a while you would give somebody else the pleasure, but apparently it's midas derech eretz that you should stick with the same people who hosted you. And Rav Soloveitchik commented, it's also in this book, Abraham's Journey, that's kind of a combination of the ideas, that Avram was not changed by his wealth. So sometimes people become wealthy and they dump all their old friends. They get rid of everybody who was with them until now. So if you take all these ideas together, together with the Gemara, what the Gemara is essentially saying is that midas derech eretz is that even when a person becomes a different financial category, a person does better, so he should still use his old achtani, he should still have his old friends, he shouldn't change who he is on a personal level and start betraying all the people who were there for him on the other side of the fence. And Davka Avram made this point, but even now that he's richer, he went and he paid back his debts, yes, but he also made a point of being with the same people who he was with in his previous financial state. Okay, so then the last pasuk in Ilya says that El Makom HaMizbeach Asher Asa Sham Barishona Vayikra Sham Avram B'Shem Hashem. So he went back to the place where he was. Actually, just to make a reference to the pasuk before this, so the pasuk had said that he went to the Makom Asher Shamo Ohalo, he went to the place where his tent was. Ohalo is spelled Ohala, spelled differently than pre-exiv, spelled with a hey. So it's interesting because you have that earlier in the beginning of the parsha, that Vayet Ohalo, he set up his tent, so there it's also spelled with a hey instead of a vav. So Chazal say it's meant to be read Ohala, that he, or as if it's Ohala, that to show us that he set up his wife's tent before he set up his own tent, or her tent and his tent. So that works in that pasuk, but how does it work here? So it's a marker of a location. It's telling us just the place. So what's the significance of using Ohala rather than Ohalo? So here there are those who comment. Islam Darach has a comment along these lines. Others say this as well. That is to make the point that when he made the tent for her first, it wasn't just because it's Nias, so she should have a place to cover up before he does. It's a greater priority because of its Nias considerations, but it was an act of Kavod. It's a reflection of the same idea we were speaking about a few minutes ago, that a person has to respect his wife, Yosem Migufo, has to go out of his way to prioritize her respect, and therefore a number of people comment that that's what's going on here, that just like the earlier pasuk is meant to say Ohala first, that he set it up first, so even here where that's not really relevant, it's showing his recognition that everything comes in her schus, and that everything comes as a awareness of the fact that he esteemed his wife greater than himself, that he had this tremendous kavod ishto, which is manifested in halachic principles and is displayed by what he does. So then, just this last pasuk, Al Makom Hamizbeach Asher Asa Sham Barishona. So Barishona that he had made before. So what does that mean? He had made it before. So you have to translate Barishona as before because it doesn't mean first. As Mitziv comments, this isn't the first Mizbeach that he ever made. So what is the idea of Barishona? So he notes there that there is an idea that it's good if a person wants to build a shul, a person wants to build a yeshiva, to build it in a place where there had been one before. To take a place that has a spiritual history and to continue that history, to build upon it, that's better than trying to take a place where there is no such legacy. And that's what the Gemara alludes to in Maseches Chulin and Daf Tzadi Daled. The Gemara tells us when Yaakov instituted Ma'ariv, So it says Vayifka Bamakum Vayalinsham. And Chazal said that Bamakum was the same Makum that his ancestors had been in. And he says, could it be that I'll be in the same place they daven and I won't daven, so I have to daven too? So it's the same idea that this place that's been used for tefillah in the past, has been used for avod in the past, it should be used again for that purpose. That's the ideal. It should be built on. It's a fascinating thing if you have the opportunity to visit Russia, to visit the Ukraine, or even to visit Germany. So you'll see there are places there, I've been to a number of them, where the shuls that are there today, in Warsaw there's really one big shul today. You know, once upon a time, obviously, there was many times that. But now there's one big shul. But that shul was a shul before the Nazis. And the Nazis took it over and they used it for a stable or whatever they used it for. But now, today, all these decades later, it's a shul again. And if you go through the Ukraine, you go through Russia, so you find there are all kinds of beautiful shuls today. In the Ukraine, the beautiful shuls. That these shuls, they look brand new, but they're 100 years old. They predate the communists. They predate, they were there before the Russians, the communists took them over and did whatever they did with them. But now they're back again. Now they're back at the shuls and they've been rebuilt. So they look like they were built last week. They look beautiful new buildings, but they're the old buildings that were shuls beforehand have been redeemed. So we have this notion, it's a very beautiful expression, that we try to build Kedusha on top of previous Kedusha, on top of historical Kedusha, where things have happened in the past, that's appropriate for it to be a place for there to be Kedusha in the future as well. Rabbi Yashiv has a comment along these lines. There is a sefer published a number of years ago called Divrei Agada of Rabbi Yashiv's comments on the Chumash. And he has a comment on this pasuk where he says something along those lines. And he has a few stories there which really phrase it as a spiritual idea that, you know, is a little bit mystical, that he has some stories where people find, they draw tremendous inspiration and they find their tefillah is better than it ever was before and they don't know why, and then they find out later that this was a place where a great tzaddik died and this was a place where something had happened they didn't know about and there was a kind of a supernatural effect on their spiritual success. So that could be too, but one could also suggest a little bit more down-to-earth kind of way that people draw inspiration from knowing of the legacy and you're aware of what's happened here in a positive sense. You're aware of what the history has been in this context and of everything that's come before you. So that creates a sense of responsibility, a sense of inspiration, and you're often able to push yourself to greater spiritual heights because of that. And there's something to be said for trying to keep that all going in one location. And when you have the opportunity to build a shul, build a yeshiva on top of a setting in which there has been a history of that in the past, so it both has apparently supernatural effects, but also a natural effect. It also has the ability to lift us up and inspire us and push us to greater heights, as is the aliyah theme that we find throughout this parsha, being lifted up to Eretz Yisrael, being lifted up by Nisayi. Nisayi means to lift up as well. But we hope for more positive ways to be lifted up, but all of that is a theme that we find permeating the parsha and permeating this aliyah as well. Okay, I wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos. It should be only good things, only aliyah, and God willing, on Sunday we'll continue.